This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with the Republican political consultant Roger Stone, a man who's been an advisor to Presidents Reagan and Nixon. He has a book about the Kennedy assassination with his take. It's entitled, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. Also on the show, Bradley Baichok, the man who heads Media Matters, a Baton Rougean, who is taking aim at CBS for its story on Benghazi a few weeks ago. There was an apology on 60 Minutes Sunday night from correspondent Lara Logan. We'll talk with Bradley Baichok about where this story goes from here. And Amy Oppenheimer, her documentary, Faces of Israel. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkster's show at WRKF.org works online. We start with Roger Stone, the legendary American political consultant, both famous and infamous, the strategist who played a key role in the elections of Presidents Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, and he also was instrumental in the 2000 Florida recount responsible for the election of George W. Bush. His book, 10 days before the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the 35th American president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, is called The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. Good morning, Roger Stone.
Jim, great to be with you.
Good to talk with you. Why do you think the 36th American president had something to do with the death of his predecessor?
Well, because I think he had unique means, motive, and opportunity. First of all, I think it's important to establish Johnson was a murderer. He is responsible, in my opinion, for as many as 8 political murders prior to JFK. Murders to cover up corruption, which was of epic proportions, just biblical proportions, and murders to cover up vote theft. He stole his first election for the United States Senate, and he was desperate to cover that up. A man of enormous ambition and enormous greed. He was facing political oblivion. He had blackmailed his way onto the ticket to begin with, using stuff from his friend J. Edgar Hoover's secret files. Hoover was the FBI director, gave him sexual dirt on Kennedy, which Johnson held over his head to shoot his way onto the ticket. And in the fall of November 1963, he was looking at political oblivion and jail because of he'd become ensnared in 2 major corruption scandals, that of Senate Secretary Bobby Baker, Johnson's bagman, who passed millions in bribes to the senator and the vice president, and also Billy Sol Estes, a flamboyant wheeler-dealer Texas con man who has defrauded the U.S. government for millions and kicked back to Johnson. So Johnson is facing the prospect not only of political embarrassment, being dumped, but prosecution in jail at the hands of his nemesis, Robert Kennedy, his attorney general. And therefore, he is a very desperate man.
Well, let's assume, and it's a big assumption, but let's assume that everything you just said is true. Then why in the world would he still go to the lengths to have a president of the United States killed?
Well, it's kill or, in his view, it's kill or be killed. We're not talking about a rational man. We're talking about an amoral psychopath here. This is someone who is crude, vulgar, vindictive, an abuser of alcohol, an abuser of women, an abuser of animals. This is somebody animals. Who's exceedingly, he's a manic depressive. He goes from deep depressions to wild outbursts of temper. He's a sadist. This is a man who, as president, conducts meetings while sitting on the toilet defecating to humiliate his aides simply for the purpose of enjoying their discomfort. This is a sick individual. I think that's important to understand that portion of the portrait, but it was the only way to survive. And he has willing plotters here. The CIA, for whom he's been the major appropriator of cash, as the Senate Majority Leader, is furious with JFK over his failure in the Bay of Pigs. And they and the military are upset about the fact that in his negotiations in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he has secretly given away missiles, U.S. placed, strategically placed missiles in Turkey and Italy, shifting the balance of power in Europe. So the American people aren't told that for 40 years. We're told that he faced the Russians down. We didn't know he made a secret deal that was kept from the American people. America came out weaker.
Now, many of his former aides that you cite, who you say he humiliated, they speak reverently of the man. How would they speak reverently for the kind of guy you're describing?
Well, actually, I would challenge that. Bill Moyers himself says Johnson was a very, very sick man. George Reedy said that he was a monster. George Reedy, his press secretary, compared him to Stalin and Hitler. Bobby Kennedy called him an animal. Richard Nixon called him an animal. Eleanor Roosevelt called him an animal.
Well, Richard Nixon, let's go with Richard Nixon here. He's a man who's a big part of your life. You have great admiration for the 37th American president. In fact, don't you have Nixon tattooed on your back?
I do, but let me say that I also am not blind to his faults. He was both very great and very, very flawed. He achieved great things, such as the opening to China, arms reduction agreement with the Soviets, desegregated the public schools, created the Environmental Protection Agency, saved Israel. He did a number of great things. He also did a number of self-destructive things, such as the Watergate break-in and the subsequent cover-up, for which he was removed from office, although my book makes it very clear that the CIA helped that along, too, because of his challenge to them over the JFK assassination.
Well, what did Nixon, who, by the way, was in Dallas, he was there on November 22nd, wasn't he, 1963?
Yes.
And, of course, Oliver Stone implied that Nixon had some involvement in the assassination. But what did Nixon think about who did it?
Nixon came to believe that Johnson did it. Initially, he believed what J. Edgar Hoover told him, that it was Oswald acting alone, but his mind would change when he recognized Jack Ruby as an associate of Lyndon Johnson's. Nixon correctly remembered that he had met Ruby as early as 1947 when Murray Schatner, who was himself a mob lawyer but later Nixon's kind of political eminence grease, brought Ruby to Nixon and said that Johnson wants us to hire this guy as an informant on the House committee. We've got some extra staff cash. What do you want to do? And Nixon said, hire him. And indeed, the records that we found demonstrate that Jack Rubenstein of Chicago, that's Jack Ruby, was a paid informant for the committee. So at that juncture, I think it explains why you hear Nixon say in the Watergate tapes that the Warren Commission was the greatest hoax ever perpetrated.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Political consultant Roger Stone, who has helped four Republican U.S. presidents, taking aim at one of the most prominent Democrats of the 20th century, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the man who killed Kennedy, the case against LBJ. And Roger, by the way, will be in Dallas on the anniversary 10 days from now at 7 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble in Lincoln Park. Signing books if you're in Dallas. And I know some of the people that were listening to this show will be there to commemorate the anniversary of the death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. You liked Kennedy, didn't you?
There's a lot I liked about him. First of all, he inspired a generation. He was dashing, he was cultured, he was charming, and more importantly, he was positive. He was upbeat. He was optimistic about America's future. He was the last Democrat. I think my parents, who were leaned Republican, but I'm a Catholic, they're Catholics. I think they were cross-pressured. I think they voted for him. I admired him. When I was in the grade school, I went through the lunch line. I told every kid before the election that if Nixon was elected, there would be school on Saturdays. Then when we had a subsequent mock election at our elementary school, surprisingly, in this Republican suburb, JFK won. It was my very first dirty trick, actually.
What did you do?
I told enough students that Nixon wanted to have school on Saturday, that we won the straw vote.
Okay, that'll usually do it. You were 11 years old, I think, when the president was killed. Do you recall that day?
Yeah, I do. I was a member. My classmates were upset. I initially was just in shock, and then it was not until the next day when I saw, or several days later when I saw, little John Kennedy, you know, saluting his father's casket, that I actually cried myself. It was a very emotional time.
297-5633. We will take some inquiries for Roger Stone, who he used the term first, dirty tricks. He's been called a dirty tricks artist, but he's been an effective political strategist for many Republicans. Who, you're now a libertarian, though, aren't you?
Yeah, let me be. You got to be clear. One man's dirty trick is another man's civic participation. So it's, I guess, all in the eye of the beholder. But yes, I am at this point a libertarian. Many, many friends in the Republican Party, but I could not bring myself to vote for Mitt Romney. And I really think the two parties have morphed into one party, one big government, big spending, big taxing, big spying, foreign adventurism, parties. They're identical in so many ways. So I supported the Libertarian Party candidate, Governor Gary Johnson, who was on the ballot in 48 states and who got a million plus votes.
Hugh at LSU, you're on the air with Roger Stone. Hi, Hugh.
Hey, how you doing? Hi, Mr. Stone. How are you?
Excellent. What do you got,
you? First of all, I have a question, and it's simply this. Is it possible that on that 15 seconds of tape that Nixon and everyone managed to mention, that he said something about this assassination?
Well, it's hard to say, and here's why. About a month ago, you may have read that they told us that all the Nixon tapes have been released, but that's not true.
Well, they didn't have that 15 seconds or whatever the secretary managed to keep erased. Nobody got that.
Right, but here's what's even more appalling. Any discussion of the CIA or the FBI, pardon me, CIA, the Bay of Pigs, or the JFK assassination is redacted. It's been deleted by the government for national security purposes. So there's numerous things throughout the Nixon tapes that would probably tell us a lot about the Kennedy assassination, but the government has classified that information, even today, along with thousands of other documents that remain classified about the assassination. So we have, in the 1990s, late 90s, early 90s, we got a data dump because the Assassinations Records Review Act forced the government to release all kinds of documents. This is where we learn what George Bush was really doing on the day of the assassination, for example.
What was he doing?
Where we learned about, well, for 30 years he said he couldn't remember where he was, which is really odd. And then it turns out he was in Dallas the night before. He was in Dallas in that morning. Then he flew to Tyler, Texas. He gave a speech. He made a call to the FBI essentially to establish an alibi as to where he was in the time, only minutes after Kennedy was shot. Then he told the FBI he was flying back to Dallas and would be available at the Sheraton Hotel that night. Yet he doesn't do that. He flies back to Houston instead. It's all very curious. We also get a document there that ties him to the CIA as early as 1963, even though he said in his Senate confirmations in the 70s when he was appointed DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, he'd never worked for the agency previously. So it's curious. I don't make a specific accusation other than to say that he acts in a very, very curious way. There's four presidents in Dallas the day of the assassination, four men who would be president: Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Bush. That in itself is extraordinary.
And Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission.
Jim Ford was on the Warren Commission, where, at the behest of Hoover, according to the memoirs of two of Hoover's top FBI leaders, Deke DeLoach and William Sullivan, the FBI arranges for Ford to alter the autopsy record, in essence, to move a wound, the record of a wound, from JFK's upper back at the third thoracic as a vertebrae, as JFK's military doctor described it, in the actual autopsy, to the lower neck to accommodate the throat wound, which we're now going to call an exit wound instead of an entrance wound, on the front, and thus abetting the so-called three-bullet, single-bullet theory. So Ford is a conspirator, too. It's kind of a riddle of history.
The man who killed Kennedy, the case against LBJ, Roger Stone, with several other U.S. presidents floating in the background in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing The Man Who Killed Kennedy is the book, fresh out from Roger Stone and Skyhorse Publishing, The Case Against LBJ. 297-5633 is your number for the flamboyant and compelling Roger Stone, who has a theory about the president's assassination, and I'm going to forward a few inquiries that I've received online. Do you think Oswald was involved in any way?
No, I think he's exactly what he says he is. He's a patsy. The CIA's major, although they may have supplied shooters, we don't know that, but I think their major accomplishment is to plant the fall guy and get him positioned. They've gone to great lengths to create this myth that he's a communist. And they have maneuvered him into position. Voice stress analysis, technology that didn't exist in 1963. When you analyze his various comments, such as, I didn't shoot anybody, I'm a patsy, or a reporter shouts, did you shoot the president? He says, no, sir, I did not. Those analyses show that he's telling the truth. He's bewildered. I don't even think he's on the sixth floor. I think Malcolm Wallace is on the sixth floor. That's why he leaves a fingerprint there. Ties Lyndon Johnson indelibly to this crime because Wallace's connections to Johnson are indisputable based on the newspaper clippings of the day and the public record.
Tell us about Malcolm Wallace.
Malcolm Wallace is a leader at the student body in Texas. He has a succession of patronage jobs, including the Agriculture Department, arranged for him by Senator and later Vice President Johnson in 1951. He shoots a man in cold blood named John Kinzer. Kinzer is involved intimately with Johnson's bohemian bisexual party girl sister in Austin. It's an embarrassment to Johnson. Kinzer tries to blackmail Johnson or demands money in the form of a quote-unquote loan. It won't stop. Johnson, Mac Wallace shoots Kinzer in cold blood in broad daylight in front of witnesses. He is apprehended. He tells the arresting officer, you can't arrest me. I have to get back to Washington. I work for Senator Johnson.
Another question from a listener, Roger. Why Dallas? If Johnson was going to have Kennedy killed, why would he do it in his own backyard?
That's precisely why it is done in Dallas, because Lyndon Johnson controls the Dallas Police Department. He controls the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, and he controls the Dallas County Prosecutor. His man, Cliff Carter, a White House aide, has given them all instructions from Johnson. Carter calls the district attorney and says, we want you to indict this Oswald fella for murder, a state charge, but not conspiracy, a federal charge. That keeps the investigation in Texas with state officials. Johnson's in full control. The police chief never leaves Johnson's side for the entire time in the aftermath of the assassination. He's joined at the hip, taking directions from Lyndon Johnson. So Johnson's political control is total. It is Johnson who insists that Kennedy go to Texas. It is Johnson who insists through John Connally, the governor, his protege, who insists on the drive through Dealey Plaza. It is Johnson who gets FBI Director John Rowley his first political job in 1938. Rowley is a Johnson man. Explains why the Secret Service lays down on John Kennedy. Why they violate so many of their regular procedures.
Well, such a massive conspiracy that you're stating, involving what, the FBI, the CIA, several rogues, the Vice President of the United States. How in the world has this been kept under wraps for 50 years?
Well, one of the main reasons, of course, is the large number of witnesses who have died untimely deaths. It defies the mathematical odds. 71 people connected to this case have died mysteriously. It's just not possible, given about 1,500 serious witnesses or those with information. When three FBI agents are called to testify before the House Select Committee on assassinations, all three die mysteriously very quickly. So for those who say, oh, someone would have talked, not if you killed them, they don't. Dead men tell no tales.
Why was Nixon in Dallas?
Nixon was in Dallas for a Pepsi-Cola bottling convention. He was doing legal work for Pepsi-Cola, but people forget This is only 1 year after Nixon has flamed out in California and self-immolated. So Nixon at this point in his career is a washed-up, slightly embarrassing has-been. He still harbors the ambitions. He has a press conference, in fact, in Texas on Saturday that gets pretty wide coverage in which he hits Kennedy for weakness and Johnson for corruption, very partisan. Then he flies back to New York. But he has no governmental power. He's seen as done. He's irrelevant. That's why the idea that he, of Oliver Stone, having him as a central planner of the assassination is not accurate. I think he buys Oswald, he buys Hoover's initial claim that Oswald is a communist until he recognizes Ruby. He's at a very low point in his political career at this juncture.
Bruce in New Iberia. Bruce, you're on the air with Roger Stone. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. I have a quick question for your guest, and I'll take my answer off the air. I wonder whether he believes that historians like Robert Caro and Doris Kearns Goodwin are also in on the cover-up, and if so, why? Thank you.
I appreciate that question. How does Robert Caro produce four volumes and not mention Billy Sol Estes, not once? Look in the index. His name never appears. The Billy Sol Estes corruption case got more coverage at the time in column inches than the Bobby Baker scandal. It was a much, much bigger scandal because Billy Sol was so flamboyant. But Robert Caro never mentions that. The reason he does not is because Billy Sol never testifies against Johnson, goes to prison. When he gets out, he goes to the grand jury, and he accuses Johnson of murder, multiple murders, including that of JFK. He also writes a letter to the Justice Department saying the same thing. It's produced in my book. Well, Caro would have to therefore connect Johnson to the murder. He just doesn't want to go there. So he never mentions him. He never mentions Mack Wallace. He never interviewed Billy Sol. He never interviewed Mack Wallace. He never investigated Mack Wallace. He never interviewed Madeline Duncan Brown, Johnson's mistress of 21 years. She is the one who, in my book, says that Johnson told her the night before of the assassination, "After tomorrow, I won't have to deal with those Kennedy SOBs no more."
Now, where did you get that information?
Madeline Brown, Johnson's mistress of 21 years, wrote a memoir, now out of print, in which she makes that claim. You can also find it on YouTube. She made the same claim to Geraldo Rivera. Geraldo, who just the other night on Fox says that Oswald did it, take a look at down memory lane, folks. Look at his early videos. He's the guy out front saying Oswald didn't do it. He's the first guy to interview Madeline Brown on national television. The following morning, Johnson says to her, those Irish mafia bastards will never humiliate me again. That's his morning quote. Then on New Year's Eve, 1964, she asks him in the Driscoll Hotel, where she says they have a suite, and the hotel records show, indeed, that the vice president or the senator at that juncture, the vice president has a suite. She says to Johnson, "Some people say you were in on the assassination." He says, "It wasn't me. It was the CIA and those crazy oil bastards." Well, he's their boy. He only left one person out of that equation.
Another listener asks about Arlen Specter, the former U.S. senator who was the Warren Commission counsel. What was his involvement in this case?
Arlen Specter was a very good friend of mine, and we were close for a number of years. I learned a lot of shocking things after his death that are in this book that I feel duty-bound to report. But Arlen Specter was a very tough, very aggressive, very ambitious, very creative prosecutor. In my opinion, he was carrying out the marching orders of J. Edgar Hoover, but more precisely, Alan Dulles and Earl Warren to button this up. They were set to do so when they learned about the fourth bullet that hit the curb and bounced up, and a fragment of bullet or cement cut a man named James Tague. The fact that there was a bullet is indisputable, and therefore that bullet has to be accounted for. That caused Arlen Specter to come up with his famous single bullet theory. Did he believe it? Yeah, he hypnotized himself into believing it. I argued with him, usually over martinis. And he never gave an inch, not an inch. And, of course, he had his trademark arrogance about it. I think he was just an establishment guy doing the establishment's bidding. He had very sharp elbows, and he was a real competitor. People say, oh, and he became a U.S. senator. Well, yes and no. He went back to Philadelphia. He ran for district attorney, and he won. Then he ran for mayor. He lost. Then he ran for governor. He lost. Then he ran for the U.S. Senate. He lost. And then he ran for the U.S. Senate again, and he won. Gives you some idea of how dogged an individual he was.
Well, on the 50th anniversary, 10 days from now, 22 November, Roger Stone will be at the Barnes & Noble in Lincoln Park in Dallas at 7 p.m., and he'll be with his book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. This should be interesting. As we wrap it up, Roger, 10 years from now, when we observe the 60th anniversary of the JFK assassination, do you think there will be any more enlightenment about who did it?
Well, first of all, I think we should declassify thousands of documents and secrets the government's still withholding about this case. If it's so open and shut, and that Oswald did it and he had no conspirators, then why is there a need to seal anything? So I think that is suspicious, and I think that might contribute to a furthermore conclusion. The mainstream media attempts to ignore my book, some of them, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Huffington Post, which I really think is disgraceful. I just would like people to read my book and make up their own minds. But to exclude us from the book reviews and so on, I think it just follows an agenda, a mainstream media agenda to brand anybody who comes up with criticism of the government's conclusions as a kook or a nut or worse. I'm none of those things. I'm not a conspiracy guy. I'm a political realist. I've been in this business 40 years. I'm fully familiar with all Dick Nixon's warts, I assure you. My book is it's not a partisan screed. Yes, LBJ happens to be a Democrat. JFK happens to be a Democrat, but a lot of criticism in there of George Bush and Gerald Ford and Arlen Specter and others.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Always interesting. Roger Stone. Thank you, Roger.
Jim, great to be with you. Many, many thanks.
Good to talk with you. Let's do so soon again. 297-5633 is your number, and we switch topics and join Bradley Baichok, the man who heads Media Matters, who is a Baton Rougean, who follows the media and their coverage or lack thereof, and sometimes their misinformation. And the latest story that Media Matters has been all over, more so than anybody else, is the CBS blunder on Benghazi. Lara Logan, the fine reporter for 60 Minutes, apparently made a big mistake. She's acknowledged it. She apologized on the air. Do we have the apology, Kevin? Let's give it a listen. This is last Sunday.
You know, the most important thing to every person at 60 Minutes is the truth. And today the truth is that we made a mistake. And that's very disappointing for any journalist. It's very disappointing for me. Nobody likes to admit that they made a mistake. But if you do, you have to stand up and take responsibility, and you have to say that you were wrong. And in this case, we were wrong. We made a mistake. And how did this happen? Well, Dylan Davies worked for the State Department in Libya. He was the manager of the local guard force at the Benghazi Special Mission Compound. And he described for us his actions that night, saying that he had entered the compound and he'd had a confrontation with one of the attackers. And he also said that he'd seen the body of Ambassador Chris Stevens in a local hospital. And after our report aired, questions were raised about whether his account was real after an incident report surfaced that told a different story about what he'd done that night. He denied that report.
Now, is that sufficient, Bradley Baichok?
Not for me. I think some folks have said this 60 minutes, you think you're getting an hour of programming and not certainly a 60-second apology. I think from what we've been doing at Media Matters and what our position now is that you should follow precedent for what has been done in the past. In 2004, when they had the Bush National Guard story, 12 days later they launched an independent investigative panel with a former Republican attorney general and the CEO of the Associated Press. They spent 3 months uncovering what went wrong there. They interviewed over 50 people. produced a 220-page report, and ultimately five people were fired. According to Jeff Fager, the CBS News president and executive producer of 60 Minutes last Thursday or Friday, he said this is the biggest black eye in the history of the show. And if that's the case, then this warrants more than a 60-second apology.
Well, David Falkenflik, who follows the media for National Public Radio, is calling for a widespread investigation of this, as is Media Matters, led by Bradley Baichok and David Brock. And last time around, when the 60 Minutes 2 story of 9 years ago occurred, Dan Rather went down for the count, and he had the conservative media blasting him to the point that it was apparent that he was headed for oblivion, and that's where he went. But this time around, the conservative media is silent. Why so?
Right. So the day after the 60 Minutes report, it's a great question. The day after 60 Minutes report aired this year, Fox did 13 segments on 11 different shows and devoted 48 minutes to this story. Remarkably, when it fell apart the following Thursday with the story from the Washington Post, they spent a whopping 27 seconds on the topic. So, you know, I think the difference between 2004 and now is that in 2004, 60 Minutes and CBS were scared of the economic consequences of a conservative audience tuning them out. And what we're seeing now, I think, and I think David Falkenflik is right, is that there's less economic consequences to CBS currently. And, you know, Republicans were, it fit into their frame of there's a liberal media bias, like we got to watch, stop watching TV, read more Drudge Report or something. And that is a marked difference from what we're seeing right now. Now, I don't think this thing's necessarily totally over. I don't think people are buying 60 Minutes response, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
Well, there another part of this story is that CBS, as a division of its entity, was publishing a book by this man who was on camera making these statements that are in variance with statements he made to the FBI, and CBS did not acknowledge the book deal with this guy. That was a mistake too, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, the first thing, the 60 Minutes report aired on Sunday. On Monday morning at Media Matters, we watch a lot of Fox. We say that so others don't have to. And when at around 11 a.m. that day, we picked up a Fox anchor named Adam Housley that had reported on Benghazi in the past. And he said, you know, this report last night with Daryl Davies, we've used Daryl Davies in the past as a source, but we stopped when he started asking us for money. And so, like, alarm bells went off in our building, like, ding, ding, ding. Fox passed on this guy, 60 Minutes bit hook, line, and sinker, and they put him on television. So we started to corral the response to this, that obviously they had a self-interest in publishing this book. Simon & Schuster is owned by Viacom, CBS. They didn't disclose that on air. And that was an error. They finally admitted that late in the week, the following week. And they thought they could get away with just saying, we made a tiny mistake and we'll own up to it and then we'll all move on. But as we know, the whole thing unraveled when the guy's FBI report, in addition, didn't line up.
297-5633 is your number. Back in 90 seconds with Bradley Baichok of Media Matters. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And we rejoin the conversation with Bradley Baichok, the president of Media Matters, which has become the primary watchdog, certainly from the left, of American media. And Media Matters is not pleased with 60 Minutes, not pleased with the story that Lara Logan did, which quoted Dylan Davies, by the way, under another name. He was
right.
Why was that done?
Yeah, well, he's got to be one of the first star account false witnesses to try to protect himself by going on 60 Minutes, the most watched news program in the country, without showing your real face and using a fake name. So I don't think it took long for people to put one and one together. And there's been some in the conservative media that decried the fact that his real name was disclosed a few days later, when in fact, in October of 2012, after the attack, in a Telegraph article, they very clearly, someone identified, they called him Daryl Davies, so it was very close. It's the same person, and worked for Blue Mountain Security. So his name had been out there before. It wasn't going to take 15 minutes with someone on Google to find out who it was.
Well, he was identified in the story as Morgan Jones. Now,
and Morgan Jones in the story, right.
Right. Now, is there a possibility that he was lying to the FBI and telling the truth to CBS?
There is. I mean, either way, you know, from our perspective, he wouldn't be a credible eyewitness. Would not be. They wouldn't put him on a segment like that. And this wasn't something that they worked a few months on. I mean, Lara Logan explained in a post interview after the segment aired, they spent a year on this story. They interviewed over 100 people in 5 different countries. And, you know, there's been some uproar in the last few days of a speech that Lara Logan gave in October of 2012 that's public, and they showed this last night on All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, where her defense of this was that it's a hard story, that politics and partisanship can quickly make themselves inserted into it. And I agree with that. That's an accurate statement. But the issue that her speech was, this attack was, you know, unconscionable. The last time that we've been attacked in our own embassy, it led to the coal bombing, and then the next time led to 9/11. And I, for God's sakes, we're sending in the FBI. I hope we're sending in the biggest clandestine warriors that we have at our disposal. That's a little different rhetoric than don't let politics get into how you view a story. And I think that's if there's one place this story is going to go this week, people will question whether 60 Minutes, Lara Logan, Jeff Fager went in with an agenda and came out with what they wanted, but they didn't. Their story didn't add up.
Well, do you think they did?
I absolutely do think they did. I mean, I think that I don't believe that they were duped here. They knew that in Morgan Jones's book that he was hawking, they knew that he had lied to his superior about where he was that night. They didn't know about this incident report that exists that he told his firm to sort of like put in the file that he said he was not there that night. So they already knew he'd lied to his superior. And he told them the reason for that was his superior was a mentor of his, and he didn't want to disobey his order. So that's fine. So maybe that checks out. But you have to have someone that corroborates that account. And if they have failed to produce one person that can say, I was there with Morgan Jones. The difference between being in a villa in Benghazi the night of the attack and jumping a 12-foot wall, knocking someone out with the butt of your rifle.
Yeah, he tried to sound like James Bond, didn't he?
Right, and try to save the ambassador, go to the hospital, you see his body. That is it's not like night and day. It's like different millennia. And that's a big deal. So I do think that they mm-hmm. were willingly duped. I think they knew that this was shaky, and I think they made a decision, and it was an error. And they should figure out how they're going to promise their viewers, because it's a great program, how this won't happen again, and they haven't done that.
Well, the week later, as fans here in Baton Rouge note, there was a puff piece on Nick Saban, the Alabama coach, and it was not noted when that story was done that CBS has a multi-million dollar contract with the Southeastern Conference, and of course the face that is most prominent with the SEC these days is one Nick Saban. That was not noted. The commercialism of these media outlets seems to be an issue as much as the ideology.
That's exactly right. I mean, what happens when these media properties become such large conglomerates is that the way that the news division is run to try to make a profit in some cases and to create a synergy from we sell books, we have television, we have TV contracts with sports networks, and that conflict of interest, I think, for viewers is important. It just is. I think the more disclosure, the more transparency, the better.
But sometimes the big boys make mistakes, and sometimes they're honest mistakes. I think the Dan Rather story was an honest mistake, but it cost Mr. Rather his job. Do you think people will end up losing their jobs over this?
I think it's to be determined. I think, like I said, I think there's a lot of difference in the environment of 04 to now. I think that there's been, you mentioned David Folkenflik. There's been a lot of folks on this. Brian Stelter from the New York Times, who's now going to be hosting Reliable Sources. Michael Calderoni from the Huffington Post. These are all reporters that cover the media, and they've seen a lot of these mistakes, admissions, apologies. And they're not taking it on its face, mainly because they don't feel confident with what's being put in place for the future for how this won't happen again. And, you know, from our perspective at Media Matters, we watch the conservative media. We've seen this hoax move from a network like Fox that has spent so much time and energy on this. And I do think that it creates an environment that people like CBS can be susceptible to. And so, you know, this is a case where they bought the hoax, and they should pay some sort of price, whether it's an investigation or more transparency or some people losing their job if they willingly misled people. And that seems to be the case.
Well, Bradley Baichok, thanks for joining us. Congratulations on your success, and keep your vigilance.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Take care. Day. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thanks, Bradley. 297-5633 is your number. And we're joined now by Amy Oppenheimer. She has a documentary that she has produced called Faces of Israel. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good to hear your voice. And Amy will be in our community November 13th through the 16th. That is tomorrow through the weekend. She is presenting a program at Beth Shalom Synagogue on the 13th, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, that is open to the public. Tell us about Faces of Israel.
Sure. So Faces of Israel started out as a research project looking at religion and state issues all over the world and how countries, including the United States, England, Canada, Scotland, Saudi Arabia, France, how each of these countries deal with issues of religion and state. And the film itself, Faces of Israel, delves into religion and state in Israel, not only the balance of Jewish and democratic, but when we say Jewish, how much, if at all, should Jewish tradition influence Israeli law, and what style of Jewish, as there are many denominations and expressions of Judaism?
Well, when you say what style of Judaism, what expressions, how varied are they?
They're pretty varied. One of the things that we'll be doing in the program tomorrow is seeing how many different ways there are to answer the question, who is Jewish, what determines Jewish status, and there are very distinct definitions, even just of who is a Jew, matrilineal and patrilineal descent, conversion, and there's a very unique scenario in Israel right now where within the Israeli government itself, there are competing and conflicting definitions of Judaism, because you could be Jewish enough, so to speak, to get citizenship expedited, but not Jewish enough, so to speak, to go through the marriage process, because that process is overseen by the Orthodox Israeli chief rabbinate.
Now, Larry King was on this show a few weeks ago. He said that he considers himself a Jew, even though he's an atheist. Is he a Jew?
I would say yes. I mean, a lot of people say if you're crazy enough to call yourself a Jew, then you're a Jew. And and being Jewish was never really just a matter of faith. It's something a lot more than that.
Okay. Now, in Israel, when young women and men are of a certain age, I think it's 18, they go into the military for the most part. That's something that in the United States, if some politician proposed this, he or she would not be successful. Why is it embraced in Israel?
Well, Israel is a very young country. At only 65 years old, there's still very much a startup mentality of everyone chipping in and everyone having a voice in developing this very young state. And so there still are options for pacifists and other folks to do community service instead of serving in the military. But it's a very proud part of the culture, and it's kind of integral to the Israeli identity. Take a turn protecting your state and providing for your state.
297-5633 for Amy Beth Oppenheimer. Her documentary is Faces of Israel. Now, if you're an Orthodox Jew, are you required to be in the military as others are?
So it's a little bit complicated. Most people think of a monolith population when you say Orthodox, but it primarily breaks down into modern Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox. Most modern Orthodox do serve in the military. However, many ultra-Orthodox who study in the yeshiva, a Jewish institution of higher learning, do not. However, the Tal law, which exempted these populations from serving in the army, expired this past year, and there are discussions and negotiations in the government currently about drafting these individuals and drafting these students. So, like many of these interesting hot topics in Israel, it is a work in progress.
Where did you grow up, Amy?
I was raised in the Northeast in New Jersey. I studied at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, lived in Israel for a few years, and then New York City for 2 years before hitting the road, and I've been more or less full-time traveling for 3 years now.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the, let's say this was done in the United States, all 18-year-olds, male and female, were required to go in the armed forces, what is it, 2 years? Is that the stint?
2 years for women, 3 years for men.
2 years for women, 3 years for men. Is that a good idea?
I mean, I think we probably have an overflow in our military. I don't know that we'd know what to do with that many young people, but the idea of having some sort of strongly encouraged, if not mandatory, year of national service, I think that would totally change and improve the culture, the youth culture that we have here in America, if everybody took a year and volunteered with some sort of positive organization doing some sort of community service. That could be transformative for our people here.
Well, one thing I noted in my trip to Israel was that the people there are not nearly as fat as they are in the United States, and it may have to do with the fact that they get military training at a young age, men and women.
It's very possible. There's also there's a very healthy diet in Israel. Rather than sugar cereals and biscuits, grits, and gravy for breakfast, over there they have Israeli salad, which is essentially chopped up cucumber, tomato, onion with a bit of cottage cheese on the side. So there's a couple of elements going on there.
Mike in Woodland Ridge, you're on the air with Amy Beth Oppenheimer. Hi, Mike. Mike, you're on the air. All right. Let's see if we can get Mike to a bit different place, Kevin, and hopefully we can get his question for Ms. Oppenheimer. Who will be in Baton Rouge this week and tomorrow night at 7 o'clock? At Beth Shalom Synagogue, we'll hear from Amy Oppenheimer. Are you there, Mike? Yes, sir. Kevin, I don't know. You're hearing him, but I'm not, and our listeners are not, so I think we may have to forego Mike. But Amy, the Genesis of Faces of Israel, what prompted you to produce this documentary?
Well, growing up in the Jewish community, I was always very interested in Israel. But I found that much of the dialogue around Israel and programming fell into one of two categories, the first of which was foreign policy and the conflict and really foreign affairs, and then the second of which was people getting together for falafel and Israeli music and light cultural programming. And there really just was not very much offered in between. And so I deferred university a year to study in Jerusalem. I studied in a religious seminary, worked for a think tank, danced with a performing arts company, and really got involved in different elements of the culture and thought, wow, there is so much here contributing to the living, breathing pulse of what the state of Israel is today. Let me see if I can bring some of this back with me.
Well, the country of Israel, as far as landmass, is less than half the size of the state of Louisiana. The population is about the size of Louisiana and Mississippi combined. And yet, this is a country that has the second most numbers of companies on the NASDAQ, a wildly successful population. How do you explain it?
Jewish guilt and Jewish parents. all jokes aside, there has always been a focus on education and on literacy dating back to the early days of the Jewish people. So when you combine that kind of cultural element and upbringing with this empowerment, it is an empowerment. The Jewish state, the state of Israel, is possibly the most ambitious project the Jewish people have taken on in 2,000 years. And so it's a challenge at times, but it's also a privilege to be part of that project. And I think people are motivated by, you know, their parents and grandparents' generations. They saw them working as hard as they could to build this state, and so our generation perhaps achieved similar things through scientific innovation, technology, and business.
Well, and maybe it's because that 18 girls and boys in Israel aren't worried about which fraternity or sorority they're going to be in. They're going in the military.
It's true. Life gets a bit more serious more soon, quickly.
And you develop discipline and character. And speaking of that, the documentary, Faces of Israel, has received nice plaudits, and Amy Oppenheimer will be at the Beth Shalom Synagogue tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. And if you'd like to meet this fine young woman and see Faces of Israel, this is the time to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. Good luck. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.